discuss special functions and complex variables. So I'll start out by discussing the properties of the gamma function on the complex plane. Saw a little bit of this yesterday in your tutorial. I'll talk in some more detail about this. And then I will discuss the asymptotic of the gamma function. The gamma function for large real x is known as Stirling's approximation. And so this is a special case of a more general method for approximately evaluating integrals, known as the saddle point method. And I'll discuss the more general case next, which is useful for evaluating special functions for large or small values of their arguments. And finally, I'll briefly discuss the zeta function and its relations to the gamma function. Okay. So, what is the gamma function? So in tutorial yesterday, you saw that gamma generalizes the factorial. So I claimed that gamma had two properties in the tutorial yesterday. So one was that gamma of z plus 1 is equal to z times gamma of z, and gamma of 1 is equal to 1. So that this both matches the factorials, and it has the generalization of the property that the factorial satisfies, namely that n factorial is equal to n times n minus 1 factorial. No, we need this to hold for any z, not just integers, or it wouldn't be enough to completely specify the function. So this is not a very useful definition. So the way it's usually defined, and we'll see that it implies these functional equations. So we'll define gamma of z to be the integral from 0 to infinity of t to the z minus 1 times e to the minus t dt. And so this integral will converge as long as, so there's no problem at as t goes to infinity, but as t goes to 0, if the real part of z is 0 or smaller, then we'll have a problem integrating this near 0. So we need to impose this condition for this definition to make sense. Okay? So I claim that this definition implies this functional equation. So how do we see that? So to see that, can note the following identity. So this is just equal to z times t to the z minus 1 to minus t. Okay. So we can then integrate this from 0 to infinity. So note that these terms over here look very much like the integrand. So if we integrate from 0 to infinity, here we get tz e to the minus t evaluated at 0 infinity. And over here, pull out the z, integral t to the z minus 1, e to the minus t dt. And likewise over here. And so this term here is just 0. So it's 0 at infinity. This term wins, and it's 0 at 0. Because the real part of z is positive. So 0. And this is just z times our definition of gamma. Z. And over here, it's gamma except at z plus 1. And so rearranging this, we see that this is exactly gamma of z is equal to z plus 1 is equal to gamma z times gamma of z. And furthermore, we can check just by plugging in z equals 1, then this integral is very easy to do. And we can directly evaluate that gamma of 1 is equal to 1. So we've done half of what we set out to do, which was to define gamma on the complex plane. So we defined it on this half of the complex plane. Now, how can we define it? The real part of z is non-positive. So we want to extend to real part of z. So to do that, we want this functional equation to hold for all z. So we can extend by just demanding that the functional equation holds for the real part of z less than or equal to 0. So if we're interested in some gamma of z for real part of z less than or equal to 0, we can use the functional equation several times until we get a positive real part of the argument here. And so if we use the functional equation several times, just starting from the right and going to the left, we have a z here, z plus 1, z plus 2, and so on up to z plus n minus 1. So this is just using the functional equation n times. Over here, we choose n so that the real part of z plus n is positive. So what does this equation tell us? So yesterday in tutorial, I claimed that if n or if gamma at 0 and negative integers diverges. And we can, in fact, read that off from this formula and furthermore find the residue. So how do we do that? So let's suppose z is equal to minus n plus epsilon, where epsilon is some small number that we're going to take to 0. Then we can use this formula here and get gamma of z is equal to, I'm going to use it one more time than I did up here, so I get gamma of 1 plus epsilon over epsilon minus 1 up to epsilon minus n. And so this plus this is just the same as gamma of epsilon. Just do it one more time. Nicole?
I'm sorry, just to train the process what's going on. So are we have our definition of gamma and we're trying to sort of redefine it for real part of z less than or equal to 0?
That's right. So we came up with this definition. So our goal was to find a definition of gamma of z for all complex z, apart from maybe some isolated singularities, that agrees with the factorial function on the natural numbers, and furthermore satisfies the same functional relation that the factorial function does, not just for integers, but for all complex number z. And so this definition did half of our work for us. So we got it for the right half of the complex plane. And then we can just use the functional equation to try to extend this definition to for negative real part of z. I'll give you another definition in a minute that will do it in a slightly neater way. But this would in principle tell you the it does tell you the definition of gamma of z for any z. You can either use this formula or that formula. Well, so the imaginary part won't affect the convergence of the integral. Okay. So if we take epsilon to 0 in this equation, so on the top, this gamma of 1 plus epsilon becomes gamma of 1, which is just 1. And on the bottom, each of these n terms is negative, so we get minus 1 to the n. In addition, here we have 1 times 2 times 3 up to n, so that's n factorial. And we're left over with this term here, epsilon. So this is as epsilon goes to 0. And so what we see here is that, as I claimed on your tutorial yesterday, it blows up if n is 0 or at 0 and negative integers. And furthermore, we see that this is a simple pole. And the residue is just minus 1 to the n. With residue minus 1 to the n over n factorial. So this is useful. This definition is very useful on the half of the complex plane. This one is a little bit cumbersome. So let's see if we can come up with a different definition of gamma. I'm going to define these intermediate quantities called gamma p of z. Be p factorial times p to the z over z times z plus 1 up to z plus p. And so why would I do this? So you can show that gamma of 1, gamma p of 1, is equal to, just plug this in, you get p over p plus 1. And with a small amount of effort, you can show that gamma p of z plus 1 is equal to p over z plus p plus 1 times z gamma p of z. I'm not going to go through that, but you can check this easily. So note that if we take p to infinity in this equation, we get 1. And in this equation, this term just becomes 1. So we recover our functional relation. So we can define here gamma of z to be the limit as p goes to infinity of gamma p at z. Yes, Andrew. Minus okay, did I? So here z is minus. Z is minus n, so this term gives us this first term.
Well, I would say from the numerator.
Numerator. Oh, so this quantity here is equal to gamma of epsilon. So I used it one more time than the definition up here. Okay. So from this definition, we can prove the Weierstrass formula. Gives us an infinite product representation for the gamma function. So let's go through this. So we'll use this identity. P to the z is equal to e to the z log p. So if we do that in our definition of gamma p of z, so I'm going to write this in a slightly different form. So I'm going to take this p factorial and take the 1 and put it in here, another 1 here, a 2 in the next term, up to the pth term I'll absorb in there. So I'll write it as z times 1 plus z over 1 up to z plus, or 1 plus z over p. And then we can use this. So we get e to the z log p. And now I'm going to multiply and divide by some strange factors, which will might look odd now, but will make sense in a minute. So let's multiply by this and then divide by it. And we're left with the same thing downstairs. And so why did I do this? And that's because there's a constant known as Euler's constant, which is defined to be the limit as p goes to infinity of exactly what we have here, 1 plus 1 half up to 1 over p minus log p. And its approximate value is about 0.57721. Okay, so if we then just put that definition in, and instead of looking at gamma, look at 1 over gamma, let's invert the whole thing, we get the Weierstrass formula. So I pull out these factors, and then we have a product starting from p equals 1 of 1 plus z over p times e to the minus z over p. So this is the Weierstrass formula. And we can actually learn a lot about the properties of gamma on the complex plane by looking at this formula. So the first thing we notice, yes? The factorial, yes. So what I did is I wrote p factorial as 1 times 1 times 2 up to p. And I put one of each of these factors in one of the terms on the bottom. So I put the p factorial. I brought a divided by 1 on the first term, second term, divided by 2 on the third term, and up to divided by the last term by p. Okay. So what do we learn by looking at this formula? So first of all, we immediately see that the poles we found before are the only poles. So the only way that 1 over gamma can be 0 is if either z is 0 or z is equal to positive integer. So z is equal to minus p, then this term is 0. This is never 0, and this is never 0, except infinity. So you see that we found the poles. And furthermore, if we just invert this whole formula, we see that there are no zeros. So by looking at gamma of z, inverting this, so we have here one over z, which would never be 0, e to the minus z, which is never 0, and none of these factors are 0 either. There's no zeros on the complex plane. Okay. Furthermore, with a little bit of work that I'm not going to go through here, but it's actually a fun exercise. You can show that this formula here implies the complement formula. And you derive this by looking at an infinite product representation for sine. So this is known as the complement formula. And also fairly important for using gamma functions. So one thing we notice immediately from this is we get an exact value for gamma of 1/2. So this formula tells us that gamma of 1/2 squared is equal to pi, or gamma of 1/2 is equal to square root of pi. So also from this formula, which I'm not going to show either, but can show, is that gamma of x plus 1/2 is equal to square root of pi over 2 to the 2x minus 1 gamma of 2x. So this is the duplication. Okay. Oh, and there's one other thing that we get from the complement formula. So, yes. Yes.
So we saw one use of the complement formula, which is calculating gamma of 1/2. But when would we want to use these? Why are they significant?
So in many calculations, for example, in quantum field theory, you'll run across, your calculation will give you a product of gamma functions in your answer. Sometimes you'll have products of gamma functions upstairs, some downstairs, and you Using these formulas, you're sometimes going to get a simple result out of this mess of products and ratios of gamma functions. You'll look at an example of this in your tutorial this afternoon. Okay, so let's like to mention one other consequence of the complement formula. So let's look at a plot of gamma of x on the real line. So we know that there are poles at negative integers. And so there are, and furthermore, I argue that there are no zeros. So gamma of x for x positive has to look something like this. No, it can't cross zero, and it goes to infinity as n factorial goes to infinity, as x goes to infinity. If we look at, use the complement formula for some value of gamma between 0 and 1, we see that gamma between 0 and negative 1 has to be negative. So it should look something like this. Diverges at 0 and 1. And likewise, by applying this again, using a value here, we can see that it should alternate sign in integral, various intervals, and should get closer and closer to 0 as well. So the next thing I'd like to talk about is Stirling's approximation. So we want to approximate n factorial for n large. And or equivalently, gamma of x for large real x. So why am I talking about this? This is a simple example of a more general method that I'll tell you about after I go through this that is useful for finding approximate values of any functions for x large or small, which is applications all over physics if you're doing perturbation theory. Okay, so let's start by looking at, or if we want n factorial, we should look at gamma of x plus 1. So we want to approximate this, which using the first definition I gave you, is this. And so if x is large, then this integrand is large only in a small region. So this first factor gets small very quickly for t large, and this second factor gets small very quickly for t small. So only in some small region will this product be large. So before we use this idea to come up with an approximation, let's make a change of variables. Say t is wx. If we do this, we get this formula. And I'm going to define a function f of w to be just this thing in the exponent. So the integrand should be largest when f is at a minimum. So if f is small, then this exponential will be large. So we're going to try to approximate this by looking at where f has a minimum. And so the derivative of f is just 1 minus 1 over w. And this is equal to 0 if at w is equal to 1. So the integrand is maximized at w equals 1. So we can try to approximate f by expanding it near w equals 1. And so you would just plug in f of 1 is 1, and the second derivative also is 1 at 1. So we'll keep the first two terms for now. So if we plug this back into our definition, we get and so now we can start to make some approximations. So if x is large, only a small region around w equals 1 is going to contribute, because the integrand will get, the absolute value of the integrand will become large very quickly if you go away from that. So we can neglect these terms. If x is sufficiently large. So that leaves us with this. And furthermore, if for the same reason I just said, only a small region around w equals 1 is going to contribute. So the region, so we can extend this integral, instead of being to 0, to minus infinity, because the integral from minus infinity to 0 should be very small, as long as x is large enough. And so this final formula is something you learned how to evaluate in Lilia's course. And so you just evaluate that, you get this result. And so this is it's known as Stirling's formula, if you replace x plus 1 with n factorial, or with n. And so we see immediately how we could improve this approximation. So if we kept more terms, and wrote it like this, then we could, again, use the techniques you learned in Lilia's course to evaluate each of these terms. And I won't go through calculating this, but just note that if we did this and kept one more term, we would get okay, so a few comments about this result. So this is what is known as an asymptotic series. So that's what I mean by this squiggly line, and let me define that a little more carefully. Okay. So as X becomes large, the approximation becomes better. With a fixed number of terms. So we write, we just have some general function f of z. The asymptotic series for it can be written like this. If this limit is 0 for all m. In particular, the sum may not converge. So I'm not going to talk in detail about this subject. It's a rich and interesting subject. But just wanted to point out that this is basically what we're doing all the time in QFT. So in QFT, we often expand in a small parameter, lambda. So can use, it's basically doing this with something small instead of something large. And so if we have an asymptotic series for some quantity in QFT that we're expanding perturbatively, product, here? The second line. Sorry, yeah, you're right. That should be a plus. Well, that's just so that's just saying how fast it, how quickly it has to approach zero. So without without this factor. So this factor makes it more difficult for this thing to go to zero. Because this factor goes to infinity, so we need this difference to go to zero faster than that. That's the reason I have that. So now this is what we do all the time in perturbative quantum field theory. But exactly the same asymptotic series. Can be written for something if we add a term e to the minus 1 over lambda, because this, if we evaluate any of its derivatives at 0, we get 0, so it wouldn't change our asymptotic series at all. So this is what's called a non-perturbative effect. Okay, so that's just an aside. So how can we generalize this? Okay, so suppose we want to evaluate an integral. So we want this for large real z. And let's suppose that I is given by a contour integral, some function w e to the z times another function of w. And it's going to be useful to break up f into its real and imaginary parts. So write this. Times e to the z times the real part of f w plus iz Okay. So how can we generalize the method we used before to this case? So if this term weren't here, we could use the same basic idea. This integral would be dominated by when the real part of f of w is largest. So that's one condition we need for our approximation to work, but it's not the only one. Yes, let me write that down. So we might expect the dominant contributions to I to come from a region where the real part of f of z is large. So large because I didn't put a minus sign in my definition. However, if Z is large and the imaginary part is changing, then the phase of this integral is could be changing very rapidly. And we might have a large absolute value of the integrand, but if the phases change quickly, it might not contribute anything to the integral. So we must also demand that the imaginary part of f of z is approximately constant. And let me just give names to the real part and imaginary part. I'll call this v, and I'll call this u. Or otherwise, contributions with different phases will cancel. Okay. So let t hat be the tangent vector of the curve. To the curve at a point W naught. So W naught is the point where the dominant contributions come from. So let's state our conditions mathematically. So the first condition says that we want the real part to be a local maximum. So that means that the gradient of u dot dotted with t should be 0. The second condition, similar, gradient of v dotted with t also has to be 0 for phase to be stationary. But we also know that gradient of u dotted with the gradient of v is 0 by the Cauchy-Riemann equations. And so here we have three orthogonal vectors, if u and v are not 0, in the two-dimensional plane of the real and imaginary part of w. So that's inconsistent. So that means that at least one of them has to be 0. So suppose gradient u is 0. And let's write w equals x plus iy. Then the Cauchy-Riemann equations imply that, partial u partial x is partial v partial y, which is 0. And partial u partial x is equal to minus partial v partial y partial x, which is also has to be 0. So one is 0, the other has to be 0. So these are both 0, and W-naught is a critical point, or saddle point. So the two equations up there apply that f prime of w naught is 0. So w naught is a critical point. Okay. Furthermore, we want the phase not just to be stationary at the point where this contribution is largest. We want it to be stationary in a small region around our critical point. So we want this in a small region, just so we don't get the wildly oscillating phases and cancellation in our integrand. So that means that this to be 0. So that means that because the gradient of u and the gradient of v are orthogonal, we have the gradient of u should be parallel to t. So this is what's known as the path of steepest descent. Now that we've gone through these additional complications that we thought somewhat about these additional complications that come from the fact that our integrand is complex, we can proceed as we did in Stirling's approximation. So what we want to do is expand f of w near w naught. And we get this, the linear term vanishes. And because we want this in a small region, we should look at the phase of this term here. So let's write this as a magnitude times a phase. The phase delta naught. So what do we require of this phase? So we want the phase to be constant in a small region of the path. So let's linearize our path near W naught. And another phase that occurs here. So we can go through this point in some direction on the complex plane. And so we want f of w to be of the same form we found in Stirling's. In the Stirling approximation. So that implies that if t here is some real parameter, this is real, then we'll have an integral of the same form we had in Stirling's approximation. So that implies a condition on phi and delta naught. So if we just compare this term here with that term there, that has to be equal to e to the 2 I phi times t squared times e to the I delta, which is equal to minus t squared. So if we plug this in here, we get this formula, and we want it to be equal to that. Yes? The minus? So that's just so that it agrees with the form we had in Stirling's approximation. We want the we want our integral to be e to the minus z times t squared. If it's that's just the form we're looking for, so we can make the same approximation we did before. Ruben?
Ensure that we're in the local maximum.
So this is a complex function. So that means that the real part has no.
But I mean for you, because we were looking for u in the local maximum.
Right.
But the condition is equivalent to that in the local minimum.
That's right. So here we're because I chose this to be a minus sign and this to be real. That's what means that it's a maximum. Okay. So this equation determines the path. So we should have e to the 2 I phi t squared e to the I delta naught. Equal to e to the plus or minus I pi. And so the plus or minus will be determined by global considerations, and I'll show you how that works in a minute. So from here, as long as we impose these conditions, it's basically the rest of the calculation is the same as we did for Stirling's calculation, Stirling's approximation. So I'll just sketch that briefly, because it's the same calculation at this point. So what have we determined? So I of z is approximately e to the z f of w naught. So the integral over some small region, so here t1 and t naught are close to t equals 0. And we made a change of variables from w to t, so we have this last term. And so the path is approximately linear in some small region here. So from here, we can Taylor expand G and extend the limits as we did before, because only near t equals 0 contributes, and then do the Gaussian integrals. So I'm not going to go through that, but it's the same as we did before. G extend range and do Gaussian integrals, and I'll just give you the final answer. So once you do that, you get that I of z is approximately asymptotically 2 pi over z times this constant piece, square root of minus double prime w naught. And only the even terms in the Taylor expansion contribute, because the odd terms will vanish by symmetry. You can show that. And one comment, the dot, dot, dot here can break down at some point, because I just threw away the f triple prime in higher terms. So at some point, those will become important. But usually the first or second term is good enough, and that's not a serious issue unless second derivative of f is 0, in which case this whole thing is not applicable. So it was a little abstract. Let's do a concrete example of how to use this and bring it back to special functions. Look at the Hankel functions of the first kind, second order. And so Hankel functions can be written as a contour integral. I'm not going to derive this. In tutorial, you'll go through the whole thing, derive a contour integral representation and the asymptotic series. But for now, just assume this is a contour integral representation. And let me sketch the contour. So this is minus pi, this is pi. The contour goes down through the origin in this direction. So this is 0. Okay. So just need to identify various components of our formula. So here, g of w is e to the I nu w. F of w is I cosine of w. And we'll need the first and second derivatives, so let's go ahead and compute those now, which is simple to do. We just have a cosine here. And so the critical points are w is equal to n pi for an integer. So there's infinitely many critical points. But we're interested in evaluating this integral just on this contour. So the only critical point that's relevant for us is w naught equals 0. Because the other ones are nowhere near a contour. So next thing we need to do is determine the angle we want our contour to go through the critical point so that the phase is stationary. So the second derivative at W naught, if we plug 0 in here, we just get minus I, which we can write as e to the minus I pi over 2. And the formula for the phase that I wrote earlier over here tells us that we have to go through our path angle phi should be equal to plus or minus I pi. And so if we solve this equation, we find phi is equal to minus pi over 4 or 3 pi over 4. This is this equation. So this was the equation we derived by demanding that the phase be stationary along a small region of our path near the critical point. Here, and this quick. Oh, thank you. Okay, so we have two solutions here, but if we look at our contour, we see that only one of these is relevant. So we're going through our contour in a direction that's between. Say 0 and minus pi over 2, if we just look at that picture here. So that contour fixes that phi is equal to minus pi over 4. And from here, we can just plug into the formula the top board there. So we just need to calculate the Taylor expansion of G. G of W is 1 and G of W, 2 derivatives, is minus nu squared. So we have our asymptotic expansion. Any questions on that method? Ruben?
So, by the angle made by the fat residue angle?
That's right. So, on this picture, so we found that this is our critical point. So, this is W naught. And we want the angle that the path makes here to be the direction of the path. To be at an angle minus pi over 4. So we can always deform. So this is an analytic function, so we're allowed to deform our contour. So if I perhaps, so this integral along this contour would give us the same thing as an integral, say, along, we could do something like this, form a contour, so it goes at a smaller angle or a bigger angle, and it wouldn't change the value of the Hankel function. Yes? It's on the other side. So that would give us, so if we were doing the contour integral path in the other direction, then we would choose this one. So that would give us an overall minus sign.
But the contour is coming down.
Coming down, right. So
you want to go in the opposite
direction. If we chose this, we would have to, there's no way we could draw a local path that is,
so there's a minus.
Right. If the arrow, I had drawn the arrow in the other direction, we'd choose this. But the fact that I drew the arrow so that the contour goes down forces us so that we have to have something that is close to that. In particular, we can't deform the contour locally so that it goes in the opposite direction it's supposed to. We'll have to introduce loops to
it.
Right, right.
Because it will have, the integral will have the same value along any deformation of the contour. But you want to go from like a region of small real part over the maximum of small real part.
Exactly. Thank you. Okay. And in my last minute or two, I just want to tell you a few brief things about the zeta function. So I alluded to it in yesterday's lecture. It's occasionally useful. You'll see it pop up now and again. So just want to say a few things about it. So yesterday I it's equal to this sum. And so the sum converges as long as the real part of S is greater than 1. And so this function is useful in also evaluating integrals that come up sometimes. So let me just show you one such integral that arises commonly. So there's a relationship between gamma and the zeta. An integral that commonly arises. So let's look at our definition of the gamma function. And make a change of variables. To t equals ku, where k is some natural number. With this change of variables, the gamma function becomes and we can pull out a bunch of factors of k. And so if we have k to the x minus 1 here and an extra k here from the measure. So if we rearrange this equation, we can make it look something like our definition of the zeta function. So we're almost got it. So this would be one term in the zeta function. So if we sum over all k, we get this. And here we just have a geometric series, which we can sum. So this is equal to e to the minus u over 1 minus e to the minus u, or 1 over e to the u minus 1. And so if we plug that in, here we have the zeta function, gamma function, and plugging this in, we get zeta of x, gamma of x, is this integral, which you'll run across from time to time. And finally, I just want to say one last thing about the zeta function. So Riemann proved that if we make this definition, lambda pi minus s over 2, gamma s over 2, zeta of s, then it satisfies a functional equation. And it's analytic except at 1 and 0. So one thing we note immediately from this is we know gamma has poles at negative integers. So if this is going to be analytic at negative integers, then zeta has to be 0 at zeta of 2n minus 2n equals 0. Okay. So gone through in these four lectures a variety of topics, which I hope will be useful to you throughout the year. I've tried to focus on things that will be useful for QFT, but I'm throwing in things that will be useful throughout the year. And thank you for your attention.